act of solidarity was a spontaneous reaction to the Delphi bankruptcy and caused by a vacuum of leadership from the UAW. When the UAW didn't respond and articulate a message and an action plan, we began to organize some rank-and-file meetings. And at that time, we had no desire to become a caucus. We didn't know what we were doing, only that we should get together and devise our own plan. And so we grew out of that. Now, because what we were involved in at the time at Delphi was a lot of work to rule actions, a lot of subversive activity, frankly, it was an underground sort of movement. And, we felt that most of the things that they were doing were illegal. And we were, responding in kind. And I don't mean to say that we did, committed crimes, but it became a sort of underground activity. Mm-hmm. We did not become a caucus. We had no intention of being a caucus within the UAW. We don't have membership roles and dues. But as a result, what happened, what grew out of that, was a very extensive network of communication between plants. And so, prior to that, the activist, the dissident movement in the UAW is quite limited. Now it's quite broad. On top of that, a lot of Delphi people, when Delphi was broken up, transferred to GM plants. Now they're scattered all over the United States. So that network of communication has really proliferated. It's become more well-known. And so we're able to get information out much more quickly and broadly and get more interaction.
You mentioned the work-to-rule strategy. This is a very interesting issue in and of itself and how that works. Can you talk a little bit about how that works?
Yeah, well, work-to-rule, it's illegal to slow down. To somehow inhibit production. But it's not illegal to follow the rules mandated by the employer or by safety restrictions. Over and above that, the knowledge that the worker has is his own. And if he forgets or says, I don't know, he can't be punished for that. And in one of my simplest examples is I'm operating a machine at Delphi, a complicated machine. The machine stops. The supervisor asks me what's wrong. I say, I don't know. So he calls the job setter over. He asks the job setter, can you fix it? And he says, I don't know what's wrong. So then they call out a tradesperson, an electrician, a toolmaker, a machine repairer, and they say, I don't know. Now the boss is really in trouble because he's the one who truly doesn't know. And this was a sort of actions that were going on all the time. It was the old-fashioned sabotage that Elizabeth Gurley Flynn wrote about, where you drag your feet. The word sabotage comes from the French word for the wooden shoe that the scabs would wear. That was one example of work to rule, but work to rule was a legal way of controlling production.
And it can be a very powerful implant strategy to employ in a contract fight or in any kind of fight in the plant with management other than going on a strike. It's a way that you can really employ some real workers' power in the plant.
Yes, and if it's done in a disciplined, integrated way, and you get enough people working together on it, you can really start what Jerry Tucker called running the plant backward. You can really take control of production. But, one of the thing is it's a very good tool that the UAW leadership has neglected, particularly in the present situation we are in right now. Gettelfinger rushed out to declare a strike, did not prepare the membership in advance, did not appear to be prepared himself. If, he had gotten into this predicament, felt he was in a corner and needed a strike, it would have been better for him to delay the strike, to extend the contract, keep talking, but get word to the membership work tool. Mm-hmm. We need to bring these inventories down. We need to soften our target.
Mm-hmm.
Management, we need to soften them up. We need to make them more vulnerable. Also, it really enhances the solidarity among members on the shop floor. They start to recognize their power because they actually control the levers of production. And this is where profit is either made or not made. And so that would be an ideal way, really, for us to be preparing for a strike. It's too late for it now. We're all outside.
Yeah. Well, and I should point out, too, as you mentioned Jerry Tucker's name, this shouldn't be stuff that's new to the UAW, because certainly this has been around a long time. Jerry Tucker was involved with the New Directions movement in the UAW, the Reform Caucus there, and he was really the pioneer of a lot of these implant strategies and so on. So this is something that's been kind of in the blood of the UAW for a long time, but the leadership hasn't really taken up in a serious way.
Yes, and you know, when Jerry introduced it in the 1980s, a lot of the plants, a lot of the UAW represented plants were taking concessions, and Jerry was winning contracts with the in-place strategies. But I have a copy of a book that we acquired, a couple of years ago during the Delphi struggle, that was put out by the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm.
This was an official AFL-CIO document about inside strategies and working rule. This is indeed something that union leaders have some knowledge of, or at least have access to, but it's not something that they have practiced, because they've developed this teamwork attitude and this partnership with the company.
And you point out that it's a little too late for that now that they're out on strike, but certainly I know from the document that you put out on your website, I believe it was earlier today or yesterday, you certainly aren't opposed to the strike, but you feel that the problem that you're seeing is that the union leadership is talking about how much they didn't want to get into a strike, and they almost seem to be talking as if strikes were a bad thing, and you point out the fact that almost everything that the UAW has won up until now has been through strikes.
Precisely. When Gelfinger came on, the UAW president had this press conference and announced the strike, he said, no one wins a strike. Well, and like I pointed out in my Live Bait and Ammo, everything we've ever won was through a strike. We should not have to remind our UAW president of that fact. But over and above that, how in the hell does somebody say, we're going to go on strike and we can't win it? If he was a local union president and he took us out in the street and said, oh, by the way, we can't win, we'd have beat him up. You know, we would have turned around and gone back in. And you don't announce that kind of a strategy. Where is the strategy in that? That is not a strategy.
Mm.
He said he fell pushed over a cliff. Well, you don't let your opponent push you off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the whole point. You have to make decisions. He did not need to make the decision that he made as a result, and he did not have to feel pushed over a cliff. He could have come back to the membership and said, these guys want everything, and they are not budging, and we're going to have to get prepared. Now, I'm going to extend these talks. I'm going to come back to the table, but get ready.
Mm-hmm.
And then they could have sent the message for us to begin working to rule, but also preparing people psychologically and financially. I've never seen such a lack of preparation going into negotiations as we did this year. It's baffling.
The other big question I think a lot of people have about this particular strike and the timing of it, too, is that it seemed like one of the biggest questions in this particular contract round was the whole question of the VEBA. This is the attempt by GM to basically rid itself of its obligation to the retirees' health care by providing a lump sum that would fund a union, basically run a health care system for the retirees. And there's a lot of people that are very concerned that this is going to be a disaster. And yet it sounds like from what we're hearing that was already agreed to, that there wasn't, the UAW leadership was not opposing the VEBA. So I'm kind of curious as to what the major issues at this point are, because that is one of the big things that was concerning a lot of people.
and it still is a big issue. What happened yesterday during that press conference, reporters kept saying, asking questions about VEBA, because they know that that is central to any contract going forward. And we want to describe this a little bit. It's a union-controlled trust fund to take care of health care for retirees, but it would be underfunded from the beginning. And this is what alarms the retirees. They know that at some point the union is going to be coming back to them for greater co-pays and premiums. They will have to. Now, we have a contract with General Motors. The contracts, you know, and these contracts have been honored in the courts, that they can't just unilaterally take away these benefits that they've agreed to. We do not have a contract with the union. Mm-hmm. The union, if we turn these funds over to the union, we also give them control over our health care and at what level we're going to get that health care. Now, during the press conference, Gettelfinger was repeatedly questioned about the VEBA. He said, this strike is not about the VEBA. Finally, he said, this strike is not about the VEBA. Can you tell that I've been talking to an attorney? And he said, the VEBA is a permissible topic of bargaining. It is not a mandatory topic of bargaining. What he was illustrating is, you cannot strike over permissible topics. You can only strike over mandatory issues like wages, benefits, working conditions. The VEBA is outside that, largely because it only affects retirees. Retirees don't vote. Retirees don't pay union dues. Retirees don't work. I'm even concerned that they won't allow us to vote on the VEBA itself. But it is central to the contract. Now, because Gelfinger does understand that it's not very popular, it's not pretty, it's not sellable, so he needs something else. You know, if he's got the VEBA in his right hand, he needs a bunch of carrots in his left hand. You know, if he could have come back and said, look, I got a signing bonus, we've got an uncapped cost of living adjustment, got some job security promises, you know, a bunch of things like that. He could have presented a package that had some appeal. It appears that General Motors wasn't willing to give him anything to sell. And that's the way, I'm sorry, but it appears that they're handling contracts now. They're acting like salesmen. Mm-hmm. One of the failures, I'm afraid, in this is that the UAW didn't go to the membership first and say, what do you want? Or here's our idea about this VEBA. And get support for that principle, that concept, from the rank and file. This was all hatched in a back room. It was kept in the dark. We were not included. So when they come out with it and we begin to raise questions and they don't have answers, it only raises people's fears and their doubts. Mm-hmm. With the VEBA, one of the things he exposed in this press conference, he said that he had approached General Motors about the VEBA in 2005. Now, we got a partial VEBA in 2005, a smaller one that was just supposed to help offset the cost of copays and premiums for retirees. Mm. But he had presented the big tuna back in 2005. General Motors didn't want it then for whatever reason. Maybe they didn't have the cash they would have needed to put on the table. But we didn't know that. We were never informed of that. And we weren't informed going into these negotiations. They never brought it up at the locals. They didn't bring it up at the sub-council. So this is, he's left us in the dark, and now he's surprised he's not getting support. Mm.
You know, I'm wondering, too, now that they're out on strike, you point out on the article that you put on the website that you're asking on the people on the strike line to, you know, re-raise the VEBA question, to demand the VEBA be taken off the table before people go back to work. Do you think that's a possibility at this point, that now the strike is being called, that there could be rank-and-file pressure to stop any possible VEBA being agreed to?
Well, one of the reasons that union officials, I think, are often leery of going on strike is that it can spin out of control. Because the rank and file, they're going to raise expectations. I didn't go on strike to lose. I don't want to go on strike and come back and get a two-tier contract or take a wage cut or settle for an underfunded health care plan. You see what I mean? So they've kind of shifted some of the power. It could spin out of control. What I was suggesting to members is that because the union has not articulated to the public what is the reason that we're out in the street, there hasn't been a very clear articulation of the strike and what the plan is, that we need to articulate it ourselves, and that we need to send that message to our co-workers and to the union. We don't want the FIBA, we don't want a two-tier, and we don't want the cost of living to be diverted or capped. You know, and we want to protect the retirees. They already earned everything that they have. They don't even have a legal right to go back and take away from retirees. This is fundamentally wrong.
Mm-hmm. What are the other big issues that you see in this contract round besides the VEBA?
Well, what I've heard is that what General Motors has actually offered is worse than the Delphi contract. Mm-hmm. They want wage cuts. They want two-tier. They want to eliminate pensions for new hires, you know, move them to a 401k. They want to limit health care, want new attendance policies, what they call no-fault attendance. In other words, there's no good reason to be absent from work. nothing humanly, you know. Fewer break times, work rule changes. It goes on and on and on. They want to take us back to 1926. Mm. You know, everything that's why I was saying in that ammo, everything that we've ever earned and ever fought for, they want to take away. Now, Gettelfinger, and not entirely unjustifiably, expected that, you know, they would bargain, and apparently they're not pulling back. They're not giving him anything. He can really go back to the membership, but he can't come back and tell us we're going to take a wage cut. General Motors workers, 65% are within 5 years of retirement. Now, that means that the majority of workers are in their 50s. They're seasoned veterans. They've been through a lot of contracts. They understand that the auto industry is cyclical, that GM makes a lot of money 1 year and loses money a couple years later, and they've been through this, and they've been through a lot of contracts. They're not likely to ratify big concessions. I would expect that the present membership might say, okay, we will hold. In other words, we don't expect gains, but we don't expect to give anything up. I could see that happening. And that's why I don't understand the rush to strike.
One of the other big concerns I know within members of the UAW in regards to GM and as well as the other automakers is this whole issue of two-tier systems being, you know, created where newer hires are receiving lower wages, less benefits, and so on as employees that are there already, or these, you know, the expansion of temporary positions, that kind of thing. Is that one of the big concerns in this contract fight as well?
It is a big concern, and it's socially degenerate to sacrifice the generation that follows us. And I think that older workers understand that our security going forward, moving into retirement, is really dependent on the people that we leave behind. Mm-hmm. We're not anxious to stab them on the back as we go out the door. Mm-hmm. The temporary issues, see, during the Delphi transition and all these, you know, they were just closing all these plants and shutting them down, sending their jobs overseas. So a lot of Delphi workers transferred into General Motors. A lot of General Motors workers retired. And then the transition, the union allowed them to hire all these temporary workers. Well, there's thousands of them in the GM system right now. Mm. And it's it's a second-class membership, the sort of Jim Crow section, if you will, where they have workers who pay union dues but don't have any rights, don't have any seniority. It puts the local union in a terrible position because they have a legal responsibility to represent them, but they don't have any contractual language to represent them. Management can pretty much tell them to do anything they want, and they're underpaid. They don't get insurance. They've saved that company, General Motors, you know, I've heard an analyst go as high as $1 billion last year. So they've already had this, you know, enormous savings, and General Motors would like to continue that. They would like to expand the utilization of temporary workers because they are modeling themselves after Toyota. Toyota in the United States carries 20% permanently temporary workers. In other words, that as a permanent condition of employment, they maintain 20% temporary workers. Now, those workers are underpaid, and they don't have any health care. That is, in effect, a two-tier, but it allows them not to call it a tier.
You know, one of the other things that I think you've done a really good job of explaining that's really a myth is the whole issue that GM or the automakers in general are losing money and that they're not profitable anymore. You point out quite often in the writings I've seen of yours and also I've heard you speak a number of times that these are companies that are making plenty of money and they're making it off the backs again of a lot of these workers like the temporary workers and so on that are getting shafted or the concessions that the unions accepted over the last decade or more. Do you know where GM is at this year in particular?
Last quarter, according to GM's annual report, they made $1.2 billion in the last quarter and $78 million in North America. So this isn't a company that's losing money right now, and they are busy trying to conceal how much profit they're making because they're in negotiations. So that's probably, they've probably made more than that. But a multinational corporation has a lot of advantages in its books, because it is multinational, of moving money around. One of the most egregious things that I see is that these companies like General Motors and Delphi and other multinational companies are transferring assets from the United States overseas. That is, they refer to us as legacy costs, and they complain about the legacy cost. Well, those assets are our legacy wealth. That is wealth that labor created. And when I'm talking about wealth, not just the assets of the company itself, but the communities that allowed that company to flourish, the communities that built the roads, the schools, the hospitals, that provided that workforce, all of that wealth, they are trashing it. They are trashing these communities, extracting that wealth, and taking it overseas and reinvesting it. What I'm saying is, and many of us are saying is, that is our legacy. That is our wealth. We earned that. Now, you can't come back and tell us that you can't afford the retirees. You can. You've just decided to do something else with the money.
Well, Greg, you're always an excellent analyst on issues in the UAW. I really appreciate you taking out time to talk to me during this strike. I know that I'll definitely be getting a hold of you again after this is eventually resolved to see where things are at and get your take on that as well.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jerry. Good talking to you.